The children of the night are calling on their see-through phones, wearing their jelly shoes. The point is, they are calling, and that this is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome to another wonderful episode of Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects, our weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that sinks its teeth into everything except irony. We don't truck with irony. Irony is kind of like our garlic. We don't respond very well to it.
It's our crucifix.
It is our crucifix.
People hold up irony. It's like, no.
No. But this is Brian Salisbury, and I was the writer of the column back when it was in its paper version, and now...
Paper.
It's cyber paper version, and now we just sit around and shoot the breeze about our favorite cult and exploitation films. And by we, I of course mean myself and my partner, my co-pilot, screenwriter, novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Yeah.
Yes, acknowledged.
Yes, acknowledged. I concur.
Awesome.
Why didn't I concur?
You should have concurred. Well, Junk Food Cinema is available on the iTunes. If you just search Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section, you can also find us on Stitcher. If you're on iTunes, please do give us a 5-star rating and leave a review. We really like to see those. In fact, I am going to read a very nice review that we got just recently, and it was from someone called The Back of Forrest Whitaker's Neck. And it says, I grew up watching genre films and was just sick of people telling me how stupid everything I watch is. Now with podcasts like Junk Food Cinema, it warms my heart to hear the films discussed intelligently with a peppering of some behind-the-scenes knowledge. Highly recommend this podcast. These guys give these films their directors and actors the respect they deserve. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The Back of Forrest Whitaker's Neck.
The iTunes. I like to listen to the iTunes when I smoke the weed for the cancer that I have, because I'm dying of the cancer.
Dying of the cancer. Smoking all the weeds. And yet here we are.
And here we are.
You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. That's all the housekeeping stuff. So vampires.
There's a few '80s.
There's a few vampire movies in the history of cinema. Just a couple,
a handful.
Just some of the earliest films,
a sprinkling
ever made were vampire movies. And so you know, there's a lot of them out there. And decade by decade, they tend to change.
Yeah, every decade has its own look and feel to vampire movies. And you know, you start out with, you know, Nosferatu and the really creepy ideas that would become part of mainstream vampire iconography. You move into the 30s with the cool early Universal stuff, and then you move into the 40s with the goofy Universal stuff. And then in the 50s, you start having a lot of the, you get into full camp with a lot of those vampire films. And then you get into the 60s and the Hammer stuff, and it starts getting very serious and very dark again.
Uh-oh. The Hammer stuff.
Please, Hammer. Don't hurt them. So you get into that. And then in the 70s, you get kind of this throwback era where, people are starting to take vampires very seriously again and not so much low budget. And then you hit the 80s. And the 80s is a really fun, interesting time for vampires. And some of the best loved popcorn vampire films all came from this era.
Definitely. And, you know, we have compiled a list of some of our favorites of the era, and we're going to talk a little bit not only about what makes the movies great, but what makes them so 80s. What they have done to combine the zeitgeist of the era in which they were made with sort of the classic rules and the classic conventions of a vampire. And we're going to start with one of my favorite films, period, which is The Lost Boys.
The Lost Boys is an insanely fun film by a really hip, interesting writer-director really did a bang-up job with this movie.
Yeah.
Of course, it's
Joel Schumacher.
Mm-hmm. And Joel Schumacher is somebody who gets a lot of shit because of what he did to the Batman movies.
And Deservedly so. Deservedly However. So.
But the thing is that shit translates into people shitting on his entire career.
Which is unfair.
Which is unfair. He, you know, here's a guy who started out as a screenwriter writing two very hip, very 70s movies, Car Wash and The Wiz. And then he moved on to do some very interesting things and then became very hit or miss in the 80s. And one of his big hits was The Lost Boys, in which he made one of the most 80s movies ever made.
Yeah. Yeah, so he writes Car Wash and The Wiz, and then he directs a film called DC Cab. So there's that.
Also very, very 80s, but not in the good way.
So you got DC Cab in 83, and then St. Elmo's Fire in 85.
Yep.
A decidedly different film from either DC Cab or his next film, The Lost Boys.
Yeah. No, he made the serious Brat Pack film, which, for better or for worse, I like St. Elmo's Fire. I think it's a good movie.
I think it's because you like to be a man in motion.
No. I think it's because I do like Joel Schumacher's work a lot. I think when Joel Schumacher was on, he was really on. And, you know, he went on to do some interesting stuff. He did Falling Down, which is, you know, this really dark film. And then he, you know, did the Batman movies. And then to repent for that, made Tigerland and gave us one of the greatest Colin Farrell performances, that Colin Farrell has ever given. And then did Phone Booth and then kind of started falling off the map.
Although I do like Blood Creek quite a bit. The point being, The Lost Boys, 1987, I mean, you have a cast that kind of – I mean, you talk about a cast that resonates within the 80s. I mean, you have Jason Patrick, Kiefer Sutherland, Diane Wiest, who is one of probably the hardest working actresses in the 80s that people don't even remember.
And the Corys.
Both of the fucking Corys.
The Corys again. We're back to the Corys.
How did this happen? Did you make a birthday wish? Did you touch an ancient artifact? How did we magically get back to the Corys?
Because you said 80s vampire movies, and I said, yes. Well, then we have to talk about The Lost Boys. Yep. And you had already counted on talking about The Lost Boys. I blame you for the Corys, my friend. Although I think Dream a Little Dream was my fault. I think I did say, well, you said weird body switching movies, and I said, well, Dream a Little Dream's a really cool weird one.
Yeah.
And then so the Corys are something that hopefully we won't have to touch on too many more times. But
we're going to stop touching the Corys for a while. But before we stop touching the Corys, we're going to talk about how this is the best of the Corey team up movies.
Yes.
I mean this
hands
sincerely.
Down.
So the basic premise of – if you haven't seen Lost Boys, check this shit out.
If you haven't seen any of the four movies we're talking about today, you have missed out on some of the greatest genre of cinema that's out there. These four films are all wonderful in their own rights, in their own ways, and are really fantastic films that should be revisited.
And I believe all of which are available on Blu-ray. So we'll put some Amazon links down there at the bottom, guys. So if you want to pick up these movies, use our links, help us out, and we'll get them to you because – yeah, they're all available on Blu-ray, actually. So The Lost Boys is about so Jason Patrick plays a guy who moves with his mom and his brother to live with his grandfather in this place called Santa Carla, California. Now, Santa Carla, California is a sleepy little beach town, not a lot going on, and I believe the grandfather basically says it'd be a great place to live if it weren't for all the goddamn vampires.
Thank you for that. And that is the one of the great final lines of a movie.
Yeah. He says one thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach.
One thing about living in Santa Carla I never could stomach. All the damn vampires.
So they move there and Jason Patrick falls in with this group of like, you know, because he's one of these guys that, first of all, bravo on copying your entire identity for this movie after Jim Morrison. Like, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that you're a big Doors fan and that you're stealing every ounce of Jim Morrison's identity as your character in this film.
Well, I think that was an interesting take on that, especially considering the time. You know, it was what roughly – I think the movie was made like, you know, 14, 15 years after after Morrison had disappeared / passed / whatever. And that was an interesting take, especially for someone like Jason Patrick, who would turn out over the years, we would find out he's an actor, not yeah. just somebody who appears in films. Everyone thought he was, you know, a pretty face. And then he busted out with some really great roles and some indie work and really proved to be somebody who wasn't really fucking around. And so here you have this guy who's young, he's hungry. And he's given this great role of a character who doesn't ordinarily have a lot to do because he's not the star of the movie.
Right.
I mean, he's one of the guys going through this stuff, but the movie is really about the vampires and the Corys. And those are the stars of the movie. And so by taking this cue and like being very Jim Morrison about everything, he really did, give a performance that stood out in a film where he would have otherwise been swallowed up as just a boring protagonist.
And one of the great things about the 80s, which I think you find in a lot of these, or at least a couple of the movies we're going to talk about, is the 80s were a great time for the idea that kids would have to face down supernatural threats on their own. I mean, you look at something like Monster Squad, you look at something in the Lost Boys,
the Goonies, Poltergeist,
yeah.
You know, the whole Spielbergia era in which you put kids in danger with monsters or with things of a scary bent. And this was towards the end of that.
Yeah. And in the Lost Boys, that's kind of who the Corys represent, is they represent two complete nerds who spent their entire life reading comic books about vampires. I mean, it kind of mirrors, you know, what would come later when like Zombieland, where it's like you have a character who just studies up on what it means, what the various rules are for zombies, or in this case, vampires, and just decides to kind of take on the threat on their own. And the Frog Brothers, by the way, are two of the greatest vampire hunters in cinema. And I love the fact that we get characters that are total dweebs but are the best equipped to deal with the supernatural threat.
And the thing is that Schumacher makes the supernatural threat genuinely creepy. As much as this movie's remembered for being fun and goofy, the moments where Kiefer Sutherland is hunting and the moments where he's trying to seduce Jason Patrick over are really genuinely creepy. There's one image in there where, you know, with the bit with the Chinese rice,
yeah,
that is just so grody,
it's
and
ooky.
Wrong,
yeah.
And ooky.
Maggots, Michael. You're eating maggots. How do they taste?
to this day, it still messes with me, some nearly 30 years later.
Yeah, and the flying sequences and the way that they're shot and the camera tricks they use to convince you that Kiefer Sutherland and his, his beach bum vampire gang are flying through the air and hunting. Like, it's really savage and really terrifying. So for all of this sort of 80s kitsch, appeal to the movie and these sort of larger than life characters and the Corys and all that, there are some legit vampire murders going on, which I only point out because there are a lot. I mean, we have reached a point where so much emphasis has been placed on PG-13 vampires and making vampires, sort of digestible for young adults. And I'm like, no, fuck that. Like, vampires are terrifying. And even in the midst of The Lost Boys, which is a cheesy, fun 80s movie, the vampires are savage and terrifying.
Well, this is – keep in mind that the reason why we decided to go with the 80s vampires, at least to kick off talking about vampires, is there was a big change in vampire lore in the 90s. And what happened was two things. We had Anne Rice and her novels, which went very mainstream. And then, of course, we got a pair of movies out of it. And then Vampire the Masquerade, the role-playing game, in which all of a sudden people who are hardcore vampire fans could play a game in which you played vampires. And slowly the vampires from the very early books evolved from being these creepy, scary things into being these seductive, metrosexual, supernaturals, to ostensibly becoming superheroes. And that led to the evolution to what we have now with Twilight, in which you have vampires that aren't really vampires, in that they can control their urges for the most part, and they can live off meat, and they can fall in love and be, ordinary people for the most part. They just don't age, and they're super sexy. 80s vampires hadn't gotten there yet. So vampires were still monsters. They were still scary. And what they had on the earlier iterations of them was in the 80s, they had a sense of brutality. 80s vampires are brutal. They are brute force takers. They are essentially rapists to a certain degree that, you know, create these terrible violent crimes on people that maybe kill you, maybe worse, don't. And this is a movie in which those vampires are very much, they are, you know, they are a gang, and they are a gang in every way that you'd be afraid of a gang, except that they can also fly and walk on the walls and kick the shit out of anybody that comes for them.
Yeah. And another thing that really needs to be mentioned when we talk about 80s vampire movies and specifically The Lost Boys is a really great soundtrack. And it has that great that Cry Little Sister song. Cry Little Sister. But also has one of the
used since then in every strip club known to man.
And I'm okay with it because it makes me wish for an 80s vampire themed strip club. I mean, you know, not like the Titty Twister in From Dusk Till Dawn, but a strip club that really kind of
– with orange eyeshadow and curly bangs.
Yeah, and I can walk in there with a mullet and gloves.
Cry, little sister, how can I fall?
But it also,
and they all dance to that song. It's very creepy.
It also has one of the weirdest soundtrack / music sequences I've ever seen. Which is the oiled up saxophone player on the beach?
Like I said, it's very 80s.
Can someone please explain to me what the fuck is this guy wearing Zubaz pants and no shirt who is clearly a bodybuilder and is like pumping his fists and dancing around and then plays a saxophone every like couple of minutes? And it's just like, and this is a concert that people are attending and having a good time. I don't get it. That's one of the weirder moments in any of the films we're going to talk about.
It's because you didn't grow up in that era and didn't realize that was real. Do you not realize that Kenny G was a thing?
First of all, no. You can't.
Kenny G was a thing. You can't use that excuse. People liked Kenny G.
You can't use that excuse because even within that era, it doesn't make any – like the collection of images – like the rest, none of the rest of the band looks like him. The songs aren't particularly saxophone heavy.
Every song in the 80s had a saxophone breakdown at one point. Like you'd be listening to a song and then the saxophone would happen.
Look, I love Careless Whisper.
You belong to the city. You belong to the night.
I love Careless Whisper as much as the next guy. And yes, that saxophone solo is
amazing.
Unless
the next guy's me because I love Careless Whisper more than anyone.
That's a weird thing to one up somebody on, but sure, okay. But it's still like completely out of left field. And even within that band that's performing, the saxophone player feels out of left field. But yeah, overall, The Lost Boys is an incredible movie that actually adheres more to vampire rules and to vampire conventions and what we really look for in the True Blue Vampires than most of the films we get now. So
it's a movie about vampires.
Indeed.
Like, it's not just a vampire movie. The overall theme is exploring vampires. And
yes.
I think that that's ultimately why it still holds up to this day. And it survives past, you know, the kitschier moments or the very 80s-ness of it, or the fact that the Coreys are in it. I mean, it really, there's so much going on. And that's why I brought up, the director to begin with, because he really did do, he was doing some really, really cool inventive stuff, in the first 20 years of his career that mm-hmm. just really showed how hungry he was and how creative he was. And even in pop like this, he was able to layer in lots of interesting ideas and just some really smart stuff. And this is one of his best films.
And moving on from there, I mean, Lost Boys is my favorite film on the list, but as cool as Kiefer Sutherland's gang is and as vicious as they are not the most badass vampires on this list. The most badass vampires on this list goes to the roving band of bloodsuckers in the RV in Near Dark.
Which is my favorite vampire film of all time.
Near Dark was directed by Kathryn Bigelow, who, you know, more recently has made a splash with films like Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. I'm going to say this. For people that actually like Twilight, I don't know why you're listening to this show, but if you happen to be listening to the show and you do like Twilight, this is probably the closest thing you're going to get to Twilight just in plot construction, except that the vampires are actually awesome. So it's still very much about, it's a vampire that falls in love with a human, but it has more of an organic feel to it, like the way that they meet and – you know, that he really wants to be with her, and then they have this conflict, and she can't resist her urges, and she ends up biting him. And then he's immediately abducted by the – as he's trying to run home and the sun is coming up, he's abducted by this roving gang of like this weird sort of fictive kin vampire family led by Lance Henriksen. And first of all, you have three actors in this van who were all in Aliens, which is what I love about it. It's like an Aliens reunion in this RV.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is Kathryn Bigelow was for a period of time married to Cameron.
Yeah. So the crossover there is pretty easy to understand. But it's like Lance Henriksen, Jeanette Goldstein, and Bill Paxton are part of this family. As Jenny Wright is May. She's the younger female vampire who our hero, Caleb, played by Adrian Pasdar, falls in love with. And then there's the little kid vampire, the little boy vampire, who's actually not a little boy. He's several hundred years old. I think Joshua John Miller is the name of the actor. He turned up in things like Teen Witch and all these like nerdy little brother roles. He's probably the weirdest one in the group, but like the whole movie revolves around this band of vampires kind of taking Caleb in because he's been bitten, but he's not been bled out. So he's going to become a vampire. And he's just kind of a hostage with them as they go around and do their hunts.
And brutally so.
Yes.
The thing I love about this movie, the thing that makes this my favorite vampire movie, it is the only vampire movie I know of in which not only is it a great vampire movie, but they never once use the word vampire. This movie goes the entire movie without once saying it. There's this great line in which they're talking about it and he's like, "What are we?" And the person says, "We don't know."
Yeah.
And we just always have been. And it's this notion of, you know, so many of these movies, especially in the 80s, all of these movies, two of them that we're going to talk about tonight, you know, the previous one and one coming up, are very much about pop culture, vampires and what the vampire had become and the myths about vampires. And this one is a 180 from that. This is a universe where nobody knows what the fuck a vampire is. And they're scary again and they are brutal. And yeah, like you had said from the beginning, you know, the Kiefer Sutherland's band was scary. Nothing compared to this. These people, when they finally go to town, when somebody fucks up and they've got to do something about it, they kill every motherfucker in the place. It is just raw brutality, and the performances from everyone playing the vampires are just so spot on and great and fucked up. It's just so raw. It's a movie that is very, very raw, and it's a movie that feels like it belongs more in the 70s than the 80s.
Well, it has a Western vibe to it, like this sort of roving band of outlaws, none of whom are more outlaw-y than Bill Paxton in his most unhinged performance I think I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
He's so fucking good in this movie.
Finger-licking good.
The scene specifically that you're talking about, and when the movie is at its most raw, is when they basically walk into a bar and just lock the doors and kill everyone in the bar, just one at a time. And Bill Paxton is having so much fun doing it. His character is just having a blast doing it that it's horrific to the nth degree.
Well, I'll be goddamn. Shit, kick your head.
And there's even a scene where, you know, a tribute to kind of the Western influence is he jumps up on the bar and slashes the guy's throat with his spurs. It's just like, fuck me. These vampires are not messing around.
Yeah. And Bigelow, Near Dark was the answer for a long time. Whenever some sarcastic jackass would say, women directors can't direct great movies. The answer was always, fuck you, Near Dark.
Yeah. Can't direct horror movies.
Yeah. And the Kathryn Bigelow just showed here just how great a director she is. I sincerely think this is one of the best vampire movies of all time. And it is my favorite vampire movie of all time. It really gets to the heart of what's scary about vampires and what scares us, and also offers a narrative that you can really, you know, God, sink your teeth into. I'm sorry. I was trying to find another way to do that, and the inner Salisbury in me was like, no, do not fight, embrace the pun. But no, you really can get into it, and it's such a fun movie to watch, and there's not a single complaint that could be made about this movie. I think this movie is perfect,
and it has a phenomenal score by Tangerine Dream, which is so is every time I see the words Tangerine Dream, like score by I don't know, like maybe it's a little hokey, maybe a lot of people don't agree with me. I flip my shit whenever I find out a movie has a score by Tangerine Dream. I fucking love it. And again, like the whole, you know, you got themes of like honor, identity, of law and order, and you know, for standing up for what's right, and very like basic components of the American Western, like very kind of broad stroke exemplars in that way. And I love the way that they play with it. And Catherine Bigelow directs the hell out of this movie. And yeah, you're right. There's not a complaint. I don't have a single complaint about this movie. Moving on from Near Dark, the next film we're going to talk about is Fright Night. Fright Night! Which is a total send-up. Like, okay, so the 80s, like this movie is sort of a deconstruction of the era of vampire films that came before it. It's a send-up of Hammer, specifically.
Yeah.
Like, it is
deliberately
simultaneously paying tribute to Hammer and also completely breaking it down. And you have Roddy McDowall playing Peter Vincent, who, I'm sorry, could not be more based on Peter Cushing if they had actually gotten Peter Cushing to play the role.
I think they wanted Peter Cushing to play the role. I mean,
yes, you are correct.
I would not doubt it in the slightest. He's playing Peter Cushing.
He hosts a late night sort of the kind of thing that I actually miss, the kind of thing I wish we still had, is the late night horror host. I think we've talked about this before, but it was a regional thing where every city would have somebody who would show up at the public access TV station from like midnight to 2 a.m.
Well, it wasn't necessarily the public access. I mean, that was the thing that was interesting about it, was you had time to fill on these stations, and you had VHS and UHF stations, and they would have rights to movies,
right,
that they would get fairly cheaply that they could play, but you kind of wanted to pad them out for time sometimes, because, you know, a lot of movies, as we know, are 90 minutes, and you fill in some commercials in there, and that would eat up enough time. But back in the day, back in the 70s and 80s, there wasn't the size of commercial blocks that we have now. In fact, a lot of you discover that if you go back and watch old TV shows on DVDs, you'll notice that shows are 48 to 52 minutes long if they're an hour-long drama or comedy. And now they're 42 minutes. That's all extra advertising time that over the years has crept in. So you had about 8 to 12 minutes that you could fill of commercials in any given hour. So you needed to figure out a way to buffer that out to buy more time. And what someone figured out was you could have a host come in and talk about what you were watching. And so they did. The most famous of them is, of course, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And hers was syndicated, and you could get her show in various places. But every region had their own guys who would go and do this, who would do it for a living. They'd make a small amount of money being the horror host, and they would go and they would host it live often, depending on how, you know, how up to date and of the future your local station was. Sometimes they could do tape, you know, it would be taped in advance. But so you'd have these shows going on that you could sit down and watch in the middle of the night, in which you'd watch somebody riffing on a movie or giving you tips about a movie, you know, just little bits of trivia, which, you know, we didn't have the internet back then, so you couldn't find this, you know, just, I want to find stuff out about the Warriors. It wasn't there.
Right.
You had to buy a book. So these guys were instrumental in a lot of our development, and he was playing one of these guys.
And his name, Peter Vincent, is actually, an homage to both Peter Cushing and Vincent Price. So he could not possibly be more of a send up of the Hammer Day. So he's hosting the show, and, you know, there's this young kid that figures out that his neighbor is a vampire and is trying to get people to believe him. And I think, you know, something I read that the concept, Tom Holland's original concept for this film, was a vampire film mixed with The Boy Who Cried Wolf, which is entirely what happens, because, you know, nobody believes that the neighbor is actually a vampire. But really, what makes this such a special movie is obviously Roddy McDowall doing a really great job of hamming it up, playing this sort of past his prime, washed up horror host, horror movie star, who, for all of his blustering about, you know, being an actual vampire expert, an actual vampire hunter, when placed in a situation with a real vampire, shits his pants like the rest of us. And then also, just the practical effects in this movie and the makeup. And you have, you know, you have a character turning into a werewolf. You have a female character turned into one of the toothiest vampires I think I have ever seen in cinema. Just like rows and rows of like razors of teeth. And it's just all of this achieved practically without any special, you know, without any digital or optical effects is phenomenal. It's just a really incredible film to watch.
And of course, Chris Sarandon as the vampire does a really good job of being playing the charismatic, seductive vampire and then flipping the switch and becoming the sleazy kind of crazy menace and becoming legitimately scary in the third act.
Yeah. And apparently the long hours in the makeup chair that Chris Sarandon had to endure, he actually took up hypnosis and meditation to deal with it, which I thought was an interesting thing. It's like, oh, that's one way of doing it, I suppose.
Well, Chris Sarandon is an actor.
He's an actor.
Well, yeah. I mean, and you, most of you know Chris Sarandon best as from The Princess Bride. He's the six-fingered man.
Yes.
And then
No. He's not the six. He's the prince.
Oh no, Humperdinck. He's not the six-fingered man. No, he's Prince Humperdinck. And I don't know why I said that.
It's like, of course, Christopher Guest is the six-fingered man.
Yeah, and so they would end up working together again as a result of their they're working together here. And he just, he's really just fantastic in this film. And I love that because these two films came out so close together and Chris Sarandon couldn't be more radically different in the two performances. And he was just a guy who never really caught on because he was always playing kind of caricatures. Mm-hmm. And everybody bought him as kind of that hammy character as opposed to somebody who really understood what made those characters what they are and nailed them. He nails the vampire here. He nailed Prince Humperdinck in Princess Bride. And he was just a really talented guy that I don't think ever really got his shot to be as great and as big as he should have been.
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. And here again, I mean, this is a movie that on its surface is just really fun. There's a lot of horror kitsch going on. There's a lot of the conventions that we love about vampire films. And yet the personality of the movie, I think, is what makes it so enduring. I mean, again, with Chris Sarandon, with Roddy McDowall, even with Stephen Jeffries, who is such a bizarre story in Hollywood, by the way. Stephen Jeffries, who plays Evil Ed, who is our main character, Brewster's best friend. And it's just sort of this like whining, like high-pitched, crazy sort of impish best friend who, you know, unfortunately kind of falls to the vampires. But Stephen Jeffries also turns up in 80s movies like 976 Evil before moving on to a very profitable career as a gay porn star.
Yeah.
Just a really kind of strange story about this kind of teen actor from the 80s who would always play these kind of silly best friend roles and then went on to have a lucrative career as a gay porn star. It's a strange tale.
Hollywood, baby.
Hollywood, baby.
Yeah, you know, I think what really works about this film, you know, this and Lost Boys both deal with a lot of the same tropes. Mm-hmm. But what's great about this one is that it's all about being a teenager, and it's all about the loss of innocence. You know, you have these two young virgins who are kind of feeling each other out on trying to have their, you know, their first experience together because they're in love. And then here comes, you know, the seductive new guy. And it's every teenager's fear mixed in with every teenager's actual fear, vampires.
Yeah, it does kind of mash up the, you know, the 80s rom-com along with a vampire film. It has a lot of those tropes as well.
And it never takes itself too seriously.
At no point.
But it's one of those magical films that really does allow you to enjoy it for the silliness and then shifts gears and lets you take it serious as a film and plays out to a really satisfying conclusion. And it was recently remade and remade wonderfully. And in the same way, didn't quite get its due as Fright Night.
Yeah. Wonderful movie. Highly recommend you guys. You know what? And I will say this. I'm even a fan of the Fright Night remake because I feel like the remake understands a lot about what made the original so good and works to maintain those elements while also kind of bringing a new perspective to it. So I'm even going to recommend the remake.
Yeah, no. And the thing is that both of them do things differently enough that you can watch them back to back and enjoy them both. And they're really, really entertaining films.
Oh, you're so cool, Brewster.
And the fourth film on the list, the last one we're going to talk about here is, man, talk about bizarre. Like, there's been
talk about bizarre. Can we talk about space vampires?
We can talk about space vampires. You know, all the other movies that we've talked about up to now have had, you know, they've been imaginative. They've added a few things, but they've all been at their core pretty standard vampire stories. Life Force is in no way at all, in no way, shape, or form, a standard vampire story. It is based on a book called Vampires from Space. And
I wonder what that's about.
Yeah, like it kind of sums everything up right there. And it was directed by Tobe Hooper, who, you know, is still kind of, you know, taking a long ride on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre ticket, and arrives at this film called Life Force, which is about a space shuttle crew that discovers this derelict spacecraft. Because, as we all know, if you're in space and you discover a derelict spacecraft, the first thing you should fucking do is go in and investigate. That's probably the best decision you can possibly make. And they find three humans kind of sealed in these crystal, like, chambers. So they...
In Halley's Comet.
In Halley's Comet. Which was,
you know, at the time, I mean, Halley's Comet was the big cultural event of that era in 85. You know, it was really something that was on everybody's mind. You know, it was, you know, this once in a lifetime thing. Maybe if you were born at just the right time, twice in a lifetime. And so it was that big thing. And Life Force was the movie all about going to Halley's Comet and it turning out to be a spaceship with vampires on it.
Yes. So they bring these – well, they don't know at the time that they're vampires. They just think that they are people in stasis. So they bring these people back to Earth where they are revived and immediately begin to feed on people. Now, they don't feed on people in the traditional vampire sense. They don't bite their neck and drink their blood. They kind of suck their essence out. Like they drain them of their life force and leave them as these sort of creepy-looking animatronic husks that, you know, again, like the special effects is one of the high points of this film. But that's the general, like, setup. And where the movie goes from there is completely bug nuts.
It's balls out crazy.
Yeah. It doesn't stop until it becomes a sort of, like, apocalyptic sci-fi film. It is so many different things going on at once.
With a huge scope. In fact, that's the thing that really marks this movie. This movie was a failure when it came out, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And just kind of went away very quickly. Tarantino he owns a beautiful 35 millimeter print of the full uncut director's cut of the movie. And that's how I ended up seeing it. I saw it when I was a kid, but how I saw it as an adult was as the director's cut, which is how you need to see it, because as crazy as it is, you have not seen how crazy it gets. You're also missing out on like 20 minutes of Matilda May running around naked, which is what everyone remembers about this film.
I remember one of the first professional articles I ever wrote was about this film. And it took me a solid 10 minutes to find an image of Matilda May where she wasn't topless.
Oh, yeah. No, that is what this movie's best known for. In fact, I remember a bunch of people were wondering what had happened to her and then found out that because of this film, some prince over in Europe somewhere had fallen in love with her and said, bring me that woman, and set up a date, and they ended up falling in love, and now she's a princess somewhere.
Which is fully deserved, I just have to say. good for her. Now,
you know what we haven't mentioned yet?
The Dan O'Bannon.
That's literally
the next thing I was going to say. Okay, so there are some kind of the movie Alien crossovers to this, but that might be because Dan O'Bannon also wrote the screenplay for this film based on the novel by Colin Wilson. And that's one of the incredible things about Life Force is that a lot of people either haven't heard of this, haven't seen it. It's kind of been forgotten in a lot of ways. And yet the caliber of people working on this film is absolutely mind-boggling. You have Tobe Hooper, you have Dan O'Bannon writing the script, you have Patrick Stewart showing up in a role.
Before anybody knew who he was.
Music by Henry Mancini. And then you have John Dykstra working in the damn special effects department. I mean, just talk about a dream team of filmmakers coming together for one of the weirdest movies you will ever see.
Yeah, and a legitimately good weird movie.
That, and that's the thing, is it is legitimately good. And I feel like a lot of that gets lost in sort of the nudity. And there's this weird scene where Patrick Stewart speaks in Matilda May. He's been, I guess, possessed by her and speaks in her voice and kisses Steve Railsback, who is an interesting crossover to a previous show we did about Ozploitation, because Steve Railsback is in Escape 2000 and a number of other Australian exploitation films. And in fact, there's a great interview with Patrick Stewart. You probably look up the video where someone asks him who his first on-screen kiss was, and he was like,
Steve Railsback. That's amazing.
Yeah. So just the caliber of talent.
Explains Jeffrey all of a sudden.
It really does. The caliber of talent on this film is really just – it'll make your head spin. And still, it is a film that for all of its weirdest touches, for all of its most bizarre moments, is really a masterwork of – apocalyptic horror sci-fi.
Yeah. No, it really is. It's just, it's such a big, blown out 80s era R-rated movie. And it got the type of attention that you don't see R-rated movies getting from the departments working on them. But because sci-fi was so big in this era and adult sci-fi had just become, you know, the big thing. Here's Toby Hooper, who, you know, you said riding on the, you know,
on the ticket of Texas Chainsaw.
Texas Chainsaw.
For a while.
Yeah. But his name was on a movie from 3 years before called Poltergeist.
Yeah.
And, whether how much he did with that has been a topic of debate for 32 years now. So who knows? But he still had that juice. And this was the movie that sapped all of his juice, because this movie did not do well, despite being.
It sapped all of his life force. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it did.
Oh, my goodness.
But I would personally, as much as I love Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Is this your favorite Toby Hooper film?
This is my favorite Toby Hooper film.
It is, man. It is a wonderful movie. It is. Weird. It is beautiful. It is, I think the scope, as you said, is one of the more impressive things about it. Like, it tries to destroy the world.
Yeah.
It you know, all these other vampire movies we've talked about have been like, maybe the population of Santa Carla is in trouble. Maybe this one hick in Montana is being pursued by one RV full of vampires. You know, maybe this one kid, his neighbor might be a vampire. Those are very small stakes, as it were. But Life Force is a vampire movie that really seeks to destroy the entire planet.
Well, and that's where plausibility comes in with vampires and how they're allowed to do something that the other stories couldn't. Because in all the other vampire stories, you have to explain how vampires have been around this long without us actually being able to prove they exist. In this movie, you don't have to, because they're from space. And the minute they show up, they're fucking destructive as fuck, and we don't know how to deal with them, and they just start going to town on us.
Yeah.
And in the way that you'd assume vampires would. It's like, you know, that's that great Ethan Hawke vampire movie.
Daybreakers.
Daybreakers, you know, is about what if the vampires just kind of popped out and said, fuck it, we're taking over. They could do it, you know, but despite the fact that we know how to fight vampires, they would fucking tear us up.
Mm.
And yet in all of these other stories, and most vampire stories written, they're always trying to hide in the shadows and stay hidden because they know that they're outnumbered and can be destroyed. And in this story, they're just like, fuck it. No, we're not. You're outnumbered. You know, you think you got the numbers.
By three of us.
But yeah, there's the three of us. It's only going to take two. So it's another one of those it's one of those movies you watch and you can't believe it exists. You can't believe this movie happened because it's so weird and so inventive and so intelligent and cool that it doesn't have any right to exist in Hollywood of 1985.
And yeah, it's just a really fascinating movie to watch. And it's a Golan and Globus production, which is pretty awesome. So yeah, it's one of those things that there aren't a lot of sci-fi vampire films. That's just not a genre that has a lot of canon to it. And I feel like between this and Daybreakers, There's some cool stuff there.
Well, the thing is that science fiction is odd. And this is a problem that you run into a lot. People don't like their science fiction and fantasy mixed together. And
you got fantasy on my science fiction.
You got science fiction on my fantasy. I got it. Yeah. Let's try it out. Oh, yuck. Gross. People will only stomach so much space opera, which is, you know, science fiction fantasy. But, you know, you look at, you know, that's one of the things that really bugged people with the fourth Indiana Jones film, which is like, wait, I thought this was a cool religious thing. And then aliens show up. What the hell are aliens doing in my religious archaeology?
Yeah, no, that was the problem with that movie.
I said one of the problems, but that was a complaint that people had. You know, people have a problem when you start mixing science fiction and religion and fantasy, because all of a sudden, you know, there are things that they start trying to make sense of it and they start asking questions that the writers haven't prepared for, in terms of the script. And that's something that you don't have when you present space vampires, because all of a sudden, well, they're not really vampires. We're calling it a vampire movie and they act like vampires, but they're not afraid of crosses and holy water. So are they really vampires? And you can use that argument when talking about whether or not, the Twilight vampires are really vampires.
Well, except that the actual title of the book on which this is based is Space Vampires.
No. But what I'm saying is that allows you to step back and go, okay, I'm fine with vampires from space.
Right.
Now, if it was, you know, a normal vampire film, if it was, we get to the end of Lost Boys and it turns out that Kiefer Sutherland came here from space to, you know, infect people, people would have a problem with that ending.
And then to stop all the terrorists.
Yeah. And then he went on to stop all the terrorists because he was still a vampire then, clearly. He had just mastered the ability to go out in daylight.
He's the ultimate daywalker.
Yeah.
Jack Bauer is the ultimate daywalker.
But yeah, but this is one of those films that really walks the line just right. And it's a cool Dan O'Bannon film from the era when Dan O'Bannon was really knocking it out of the park.
Life force. The terror has just begun.
Riddle me this, Cargo. What do you get when you mix tomato juice, lemon juice, Worcestershire sauce, and Tabasco?
Bloody Mary?
You get this week's junk food pairing, which is, in fact, a Bloody Mary. The perfect pairing for not only these 80s vampire films, but pretty much anything.
Can I substitute the blood of a virgin for the tomato juice?
You can. You can indeed.
Because that would be a true junk food pairing with this week's.
Yes. So for a delightful take on the basic Bloody Mary recipe, just replace tomato juice with the blood of a virgin. If you can find one.
I would check Reddit.
Check Reddit. Oh, good God. And that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you for joining us on this odyssey of 80s vampire films, our favorite bloodsuckers from our favorite decade. It's been fun.
It has. You know, I do enjoy vampire films. I wish more vampire films would take the subject seriously, in the way that, with a certain amount of reverence as they did in these films that we mentioned, you know, where they really got to the heart of what made those films work. I think that's what we lack in this day and age. I don't think it's the fact that people are ever really tired of vampires. I think we just keep going through eras where people are like, they don't want to see that stuff. Let's do something new and completely different. And I'm down to new and different. But if you're going to do new and different, do Catherine Bigelow new and different. Don't, yes. You know, don't just try to reinvent the vampire.
So if you've become jaded by Twilight and it's sparkly, not really vampires, go back and check out some of the films that we've mentioned and sharpen your fangs on those, because you're really going to enjoy them. And they'd be great because of all the goddamn vampires.
All the goddamn vampires.
But yeah, that's going to do it for us. I want to remind you once again, we are available on iTunes. Just search Junk Food Cinema in the podcast section. We're also on Stitcher. You can find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can like us there as well. Cargo, where can people find you on the internet in addition to that?
You can find me at facebook.com/massaworm or at twitter.com/massaworm.
And you can find me also at over at oneofus.net, which is a website I co-founded, and I do a lot of podcasts and writing over there. You can also follow them on Twitter at oneofusnet. And for now, let me just close this out by saying simply, you're so cool, boppers.